Hi, everybody. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so as we discuss recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. This month, we're going to talk about a case, but more than that, we're going to talk about connections. And what I mean by that is connections between and among public safety employees and civilian employees, connections between and among federal workers and state and local workers, connections among public workers and private workers. You all know if you follow the podcast and you subscribe to any of our LRIS products or attend our trainings, we focus our time and attention on cases and developments that affect police officers, firefighters, and correctional officers, which means when it comes to legal developments that we really spend probably 90% of our time talking about state and local cases or federal cases involving state and local employees, because that's where the bulk of our listeners, right? That's where the bulk of our customers work. And so we don't spend a ton of time on federal matters or private sector cases, but every once in a while we do. And there have been a few developments over the last month or so that have had me thinking about that. And so we want to talk about those things. And it all started in November when I was out at our discipline seminar, out in Las Vegas. We come into a great discipline seminar every November. We're doing it again this year. We have representatives from management and labor there, you know, kind of trading ideas on discipline. It's a really great seminar. And we had a group of folks from Arapahoe County in Colorado. And they asked me about this crazy case. And I heard about this case out of Douglas County in Colorado about this union busting sheriff and lots of crazy stuff that the sheriff was doing in order to oppose a union organization effort. And I hadn't heard about it. And they shared it with me. And, I read what was going on and saw some of the hijinks. And, you know, really what was happening there was good old fashioned union busting, which is new, right? And it's surprising to a lot of the folks who listen to this podcast, because we just don't see that very much in public safety land. But we see it all the time, and we've been seeing it all the time in the private sector. And so what we thought might be kind of fun is to get an expert in private sector labor law and in union busting and all that stuff on the podcast today. And so during the podcast, I'm going to be joined by labor lawyer Joe Richardson. Joe is a great lawyer. He's based out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's with the firm of Willig, Williams & Davidson. And Joe's a triple threat, you know, to our conversation today, because he's a federal employee, he's a formal federal employee. He's a Marine Corps veteran, and he also worked for the National Labor Relations Board for several years. He now practices and represents primarily private sector employees, and he deals with the NLRB all the time. And he also represents some public sector workers and public safety workers. And so Joe has a unique perspective on federal, state and local, and private workers. And it'll be very interesting to hear his take on this, you know, pretty interesting case out of Colorado. And so we'll be looking forward to talking to Joe in a little bit. So before we head into our conversation about connections, what's going on with LRIS? Well, just got back from a really fun state seminar in Oklahoma with the Oklahoma Chiefs of Police and the FOP in Oklahoma, a joint seminar where we talked about discipline and we talked about a bunch of other rights. I love those special seminars that we do, especially when they're jointly sponsored by, you know, the chiefs and the union, by management and labor, because we really have great conversations there. And we generally will do that a few times a year. So if your state, it's a great idea, by the way, you know, get the chiefs together and the FOP together, or the chiefs and the fire and the IFF together, do a joint seminar, bring us out, and we can have a, you know, we can hear from both sides on whether it's discipline or any other issue, but those tend to be a lot of fun. We're also going to do a webinar coming up in February. If you're looking at the calendar, our next month's webinar is going to be February 26th. We're going to talk about free speech developments for public safety workers. Every month, there's a new case that comes out that just, you know, makes me chuckle. Actually, there's a pretty interesting Oklahoma case that was just decided a few weeks ago regarding somebody's Facebook posts before they were hired, right? You discover them after they're hired. What does that mean? Can we do anything about that? Well, a federal court in the 10th Circuit had an opinion on that that we're going to discuss, as well as some other recent federal decisions on the speech rights of police officers, firefighters, and correctional officers. That'll be February 26th, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. If you want any information about that, just hit us up at LRIS Webinars, and we'd like to see you there. And then in March, our next seminar in person is going to be our Collective Bargaining for Public Safety Employees seminar. It's my favorite seminar. We're going to go to Nashville, not Las Vegas, this time. So we're going to be in Nashville. That's going to be fun, March 26th to 28th. The bargaining seminar, we have management attorneys, union side attorneys, who negotiate these contracts, giving their respective tricks of the trade. We're also going to hear from an economist on how you look at an employer's ability to pay and how we develop comparability analyses. And that's a really great 2.5 day seminar. I will be there, and I hope to see you there. If you have any information or you want information about that one, just check us out at LRS Seminars. I don't know if you've ever come out to one of our seminars, but at our bargaining seminar, sometimes we take it, on a podcast, you're required to say deep dive. So we take a deep dive sometimes in person into labor history and in public safety labor history. And whenever we do that, we start off generally talking about the Boston police strike of 1919. I'm not going to go into the whole story here, but if you have any interest in public safety labor history, I urge you to Google it, go read up about it. But basically what happened in 1919 was the Boston Social Club was the police union at the time formed. Working conditions for police officers, at the after World War I, most of these guys went and fought overseas. Their working conditions were terrible in Boston. I think in the previous, I don't know, 15 or 16 years, I think they might have gotten one raise or two raises. Their standard of living deteriorated. They made about $2,500 a year. And you can try to CPI that and say, it was a long time ago. No, they made the equivalent of like 25 grand a year today. No sick time, no benefits. It was just a really rotten job. What they decided to do, and they weren't alone in doing this, police organizations and other parts of the city and big cities were starting to do the same thing, and were actually encouraged to do so by the American Federation of Labor. Started unionizing, and what happened in Boston was because of a state takeover. There was a state takeover of the city of Boston, and there was lots of tension between city versus rural, which we see today, and there was tension between the Republicans and the Democrats, which we see today. And what happened was the Republicans basically took over the Boston Police Department, by law, took over the Boston Police Department, but the Democrats ran the city. And so the Democrats said, well, if we don't have any control over the police department, we're not going to fund it. And the Republicans said, well, we're not going to fund it. It's the Democrats run the city. And so nobody funded the police department, and nobody got raises, and working conditions got worse and worse and worse. And ultimately, what happened was the officers placed the city on notice of, that they intended to form a union. They wanted to bargain with the commissioner regarding their wages and benefits and working conditions. And the commissioner said, I have a better idea. I'm going to form a union. I'm going to designate who's going to be on the union. That'll be the labor committee or whatever we call it. And then those guys can talk to me about it, right? So wouldn't it be nice, chiefs, if you could just pick the union? But it doesn't work that way. And what the chief did next was he basically said, listen, the new police union identified who their officers were. And he said, I forbid that. You can't have a union here. And I'm telling you right now that if anybody joins this union or steps up to take a position in this union, they're going to lose their jobs. The union did what you would expect they would do. They stuck to their guns and they said, no, here are the 15 people on our committee. The commissioner stuck to his guns. He initiated termination procedures against those officers. And the next day, 1,100 Boston cops walked off the job, in a massive show of solidarity for their brothers who stood up for everyone. What happened over the next few days is tough to get to the truth of. You can call it protest, you can call it rioting, Whether the streets of Boston were crazy or not for the next few days is open to debate. Back then, unlike today, back then, the media, it was a couple of newspapers and it was owned by three or four, rich white guys. Nothing like today, of course, right? But so we have like the management view of what happened. And the management view in the media was this was horrible. The police abandoned their positions. There was rioting on the streets of Boston. And the strike ultimately was broken by Governor Calvin Coolidge. And that's how Calvin Coolidge, that's how he made his national reputation. He actually wound up becoming president because of what happened in Boston. He sent in the National Guard. And these were all basically like rich kids from Harvard who were activated. And they went in, they took over the city, they stopped the violence, and the governor fired every single one of those police officers who went on strike. They were it. They were done. They were called in the media. They were called deserters. It was like this horrible, horrible, turning of the public on the police who struck, who were really only just trying to like, make a living, right? And make their jobs a little better and a little safer. They were fired. They were replaced. And to stick, a thumb in their eye, the people who, they pulled off the street, gave them a badge and said, "You're police officers." They decided to pay those guys exactly what the police had been proposing in the first place. What the union was saying, the increases the union wanted, the city said, "No, you're fired. We're going to pay those same increased rates to somebody else." That's what they did, and those 1,000 cops never got their jobs back. I could go on and on and on about it. I urge you, if you have any interest in this subject, to take a look at it. And the reason I'm talking about it is because not just because of what happened in Boston, but because that Boston police strike of 1919 had massive implications. On unionizing of not just police officers, but firefighters and other public workers for decades. We really didn't see any meaningful unionization of public workers, not just public safety workers, until after World War II, right? So what happened in Boston in 1919 had ripple effects that chilled any organization, meaningful organization of public safety unions for really another 30 years. They didn't know it at the time, but that's what happened. And every once in a while, you have big things that happen that make national news in the area of labor that have implications not just on the here and now and on the people who are involved, but on a lot of other people for a long time. If we fast forward to the early 80s into 1981, some of you listening were can remember the air traffic controller strike, the PATCO strike in 1981. Some of you weren't born yet. I'm somewhere in between. I was like 11 when the air traffic controllers went on strike. And what happened there, right? So here's federal employees. They wind up going on strike. Just to provide some perspective, inflation in the early 80s was insane. If you think 8-9% inflation over the last 2 years was rough, well, how do you like 15% inflation, right, over several years? Inflation in the late 70s and early 80s was completely and totally out of control, and which obviously reflected itself at the bargaining table, right, where people were trying to keep up with the cost of living. Air traffic controllers were trying to do the same thing too. And they were having a very difficult time in the late 70s with then President Jimmy Carter, right? Recently passed former President Jimmy Carter, who everybody, says, oh, yeah, he was this, really crazy liberal, I guess gave the unions anything they wanted. Well, that was not the case with Carter, especially with the airline industry. He was heavily involved in deregulation. He had a really bad relationship with the Air Traffic Controllers Union, for sure with PATCO. And they had a tough, very tough time negotiating new contracts with the FAA. In fact, when Ronald Reagan ran against Jimmy Carter, and the unions had an opportunity to endorse, Reagan went and said, "Hey guys, you got it." There's this great letter from Reagan to the air traffic controller saying, "I support your cause. I think you guys are the best, and you need a fair contract, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." They endorsed him. PATCO endorsed Reagan in the 1980 election, and we know what happened. Reagan won. And so it's 1981. Reagan's sworn in. The air traffic controllers think, "Oh man, yeah, contract's going to be settled, right? We're in great shape. We're going to get whatever we want." And I know you'll be shocked by this, but sometimes politicians say one thing when they're on the campaign trail, and then something different when they're elected. And that's what happened, with the air traffic controllers and their negotiations. The Reagan administration did come up with an offer, a financial package to resolve the strike. They were very, very, very far off from what the air traffic controllers were looking for, and very, very far off from what the union was expecting. This so, we thought friendly new president to offer us. Negotiations stalled. They hit impasse. This is a group of employees because their work is so important, right? They could not strike under federal law. They were prohibited from striking. They did not have what many of our listeners had. They didn't have interest arbitration. They didn't have a meaningful kind of third option here, right? We continue working, or we strike, or we have a middle ground that for employees who are so important, too important to strike, we still can make sure that their labor disputes are resolved in a timely fashion. They didn't have that tool at their disposal, and so ultimately, for a lot of reasons, PATCO went on strike. And in August 1981, they said, "We're walking. We know what you say about what the law requires, but we have to do what we have to do, for ourselves and for our families, and pay and work hours and safe working conditions were the issues then and they are now." And so they walked, and this is, about 11,000 workers. It's a huge workforce. They go on strike. This is a big test to relatively new President Reagan at the time. And Reagan's response was pretty clear. He holds a press conference and he says, "This is an illegal strike. I'm telling you right now, you're in violation of the law. I have the right to fire you. I'm going to give you 48 hours to return to work. And if you don't come back in 48 hours, I'm going to take action." The controllers, for the most part, stuck to their guns. They refused to come back to work. They didn't end the strike. They did not return at all. And what did President Reagan do? He fired them all. He fired 11,000 workers, and he banned them for life from any further federal service, right? It sounds like the Boston police strike back in 1919. What was the reaction? And by the way, in the Clinton administration, that lifetime ban was lifted. But he broke the strike. He fired all 11,000 workers. There was no expectation that he would do that, even though he had the legal right to do that. It was one of those kind of unwritten rules that, well, yeah, we're not going to go that far, was the expectation. We don't think he'll really do it. Well, he did it, right? And just like Calvin Coolidge back in 1919, Reagan, he was already president, but it made his reputation early on as like, yeah, he's going to stand up to the unions, and he's going to enforce the law. And employers loved it. A lot of his supporters loved it. PATCO was done. It broke that union. They wound up being decertified, and their folks really never went back to work. Some people ultimately did, but Reagan was able to replace them, and bring in cheaper workers. And it was tough, 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 tough for a few years there, but ultimately, the work got done. Okay, well, it's a terrible result for the air traffic controllers and their families, but what does that really mean? Well, if it just ended with the strike, we wouldn't be talking about it now. But what Reagan did in 1981 with the air traffic controllers had massive ripple effects through the economies. And the biggest ripple effect it did, right? When you're president, what you do matters. People watch that, they see that. And when Reagan fired 11,000 air traffic controllers, he sent a big signal to employers out there to say, you know what? You could do the same thing. And after the air traffic controllers strike, after Reagan crushed that strike, we saw employers in the private sector get extremely aggressive in their tactics at the bargaining table. And we saw employers in big, big negotiations basically get to the point, set things up where they could actually legally replace striking workers, bring in replacements, and just get rid of the workforce. And we saw that happen at Dodge in 1983, Hormel, big, big employer in like 85, 86, fired basically fired their striking workers, brought in replacements. International Paper did it in 87. This big, large scale replacements of workers that we had never experienced before, or at least hadn't experienced in the prior 50 years, started to become commonplace in the 80s. And that weapon, that large economic weapon that workers had in the private sector, the right to strike, really just went away. It didn't become a weapon anymore. And if you look at the number of strikes that happen in the United States each year, you can go to BLS's website and they track that, and they track like large work stoppages, or I think they call them major work stoppages. And that's they define a major work stoppage as any instance in which more than 1,000 people are gone for more than a day, right? So that's a major work stoppage. In the 60s and in the 70s, the country averaged around 270, 280 major work stoppages a year, right? Those were big strikes, hundreds of them, almost a strike a day, right? And what happened to wages and benefits, right? Wages and benefits grew. And a lot of people talk about, gosh, wouldn't we be great if we could go back to the good old days? I think they're talking about the 60s and the 70s when a working person could raise a family. That's what was happening in the 60s. That's what was happening in the 70s. And it's what was happening in 1981. And then Reagan fired the air traffic controllers, and employers looked around and said, oh, if the president can do it, I guess I can do it. And employers got really aggressive. And by the end of the 80s, the number of strikes that you saw, was really low. I think the average number of those major work stoppages went from about 280 a year to about 80 a year. 80, 280 to 80, a massive drop where employees were saying, nope, we're not going, because if push comes to shove, employers are going to get rid of us. And it only got worse in the 1990s. Those 80 major work stoppages a year went down to about 40, 30 something, 40. In the 2000s, we got down to about, 20, 2010s, 15, right? I think in 2020, there were like nine major work stoppages. The last few years, you may have heard about lots more labor activity, because the Great Resignation and more major strikes. And there's some truth to that, but I think in 2023, there were like 30 major work stoppages, which is a lot more than 20 and a lot more than 10, but nowhere near 280. And so what the federal government does, right, what the president of the United States does or did with respect to federal workers had an impact on workers elsewhere in the economy, primarily in the private sector, but also in the public sector. Think about public sector. Hey, how does this private sector stuff affect us, really? Things that happen in the private sector make their way to the public sector. And if you wonder about that, ask yourself, do you have retiree health care in your workplace? And if so, did the people that retired 20 years ago, do they have better retiree health care than I have, right? Do they have lifetime benefits and I have like a, maybe I get to Medicare, or do I have in some way a lesser benefit than people who went out 10 years ago? Or am I 20 years on the job and I have an okay retiree health care plan, but the new hires at some point in the past, we got rid of it for them, or we don't have it now. We've seen retiree healthcare benefits for about a 20-year period gradually go away. In the public sector, that's still around, and I think there have been some pretty good efforts to maybe restore and improve those benefits, especially to address recruiting and retention. But it cannot be debated that we saw over an extended period of time an erosion of those benefits. The reason we saw that in the public sector is because we saw that happen in the private sector over the previous 20 years after the air traffic controller strike. And public employers, would say, hey, look what they're doing in the private sector. Why should we be carrying these burdens that they got rid of in the private sector? Same thing with pensions, right? Everybody moved to a 401k. Big private employers got rid of the pension benefits, and then it ripples through to the public sector. So what happens in the private sector affects the public sector. What happens to federal employees affects state employees. And I want you to keep that in mind when we talk about two things with our guest today. And those two things we're going to talk about are our Colorado case, which features some private sector union busting in a public sector context. And then we're also going to talk about what's happening with the Trump administration and the National Labor Relations Board, what's happening with the Trump administration, and some of the things that it has done in the first few weeks with respect to its workforce. And this discussion has nothing to do with politics, has nothing to do with the administration's position on criminal justice issues and a lot of things that we really like. It has to do with how an employer treats its employees and how the things that we think may not affect us immediately in the state and local level actually can and do. And so we have to keep an eye on that stuff, even though we think, well, maybe it doesn't affect me today. It might affect us tomorrow. So after the break, we're going to come back, talk with Joe, and see if we can bring all these connections together. Okay, we're back. As promised, I am not alone, which is good news for our listeners, I think. As I mentioned, we're going to talk about connections between public sector and private sector, and between federal workers and state and government workers, and how sometimes in labor relations, not just in public safety land, by the way, but everywhere in labor relations, we can tend to kind of silo our views of things that are happening to other workers or in other industries, and say, well, it doesn't really affect us. The truth is, it's all connected, in one way or another. And so, we're joined this month by Joe Richardson. Joe, hi, welcome to the podcast.
Hey Rick, good to be here.
Thanks for joining us, Joe. As I mentioned, Joe's got a really unique background. He kind of has a foot in all three of the worlds that we talked about, which gives him a unique perspective to talk about this Colorado case that we want to spend some time on this month, and then maybe talk about some of the other things. You may not have, I don't know if you've paid attention, but there have been some things happening with the federal workforce since Trump's inauguration a few weeks ago. So let's start off, Joe. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, yourself, your background, and your experience in each of the areas that we're going to be speaking about this month.
Sure. Thanks, Rick. It's good to be here. So I've been a union side labor lawyer for about 6 years now. Before that, I was an attorney at the National Labor Relations Board, which is the, federal labor relations agency. It kind of referees collective bargaining and the relations between unions and employers in the private sector. So I worked for them at a regional office, doing the day-to-day investigating unfair labor practices, running elections, doing hearings in front of judges, that kind of thing. Before that, I did a tour in the United States Marine Corps. I did 5 years from 99 to 04. And in my role as a union side lawyer now, I represent folks kind of across a bunch of different sectors. I represent a lot of Teamsters who do sort of traditional logistics type of work. But within those unions, we also have a lot of public servants, including correctional officers. And I represent some private sector first responders in South Jersey.
So you really do have, well, first, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
A lot of our listeners are veterans, and thank them for their service. Yeah, you really do. So it's interesting. You've got your federal experience at the board, and now in private practice, working with uniform folks and also private sector folks. And so when let's get to this case. And I'm going to summarize it a little bit, and there's not much summarizing to do. The facts are great in this case. It reads like a bad story. And so let's the case is called it's FOP Lodge 47, versus Douglas County and the Douglas County Sheriff's Office. So where we are in the country here is in Colorado, Douglas County, Colorado. It's kind of smack dab in between Denver and Colorado Springs. I've never been there. I want to go there. Douglas County is really nice. It's one of the wealthiest counties in the country. I think the sixth or seventh wealthiest in the country. And they have an elected sheriff. His name's Darren Weekly. Not unusual system. And because sheriff's work, deputy sheriff's work can vary in different places across the country, the nature, this is a traditional law enforcement deputy sheriff's office. So, where deputy sheriffs are going to be performing traditional policing work in addition to other duties. And this is an agency, I think they've got about 600 folks in the agency, 400 uniforms. So, it's a pretty good sized agency. Douglas County is about 300,000-400,000 people with some smaller cities in there, but a lot of money in Douglas County. And that probably plays into the response. You think, oh, wealthy employers, they're probably really generous and to their employees, and that's not always the case. In fact, that's mostly it's not the case. So what happened here in Douglas County? The sheriffs, the deputy sheriffs and sergeants took steps to organize and to engage in collective bargaining under Colorado's law. And all the laws are a little bit different. And as we've discussed here before, they're all based in one way or another on a law called the National Labor Relations Act. So keep that in the back of your head. And Colorado's is as well. Some differences, but the basic rights are generally the same. And so Lodge 47 starts the organizing process to engage in collective bargaining. And the goal being, we'll have a collective bargaining agreement, right? It's going to set forth wages, benefits, other terms of employment for a period of time. It's what most of our listeners engage in, hopefully every few years, right? And so they do a survey to look for support. They got about 75% support of the unit. The unit is all of the basically the equivalent of like the officers and the sergeants. Some differences in state laws about who can be in a unit. Can everybody be in the same unit? Are they separate? This is a group that would contain the kind of patrol deputies and the sergeants. And everything was going good, right? They're having a lot of success apparently, a lot of support. The FOP, kicks off the organizing campaign. The local officer who works there, and he sends an email to his colleagues. And this is, I think, in February or March of 24, so it's not too terribly long ago. And so, email goes out to the group saying, "Hey guys, we're moving forward. We did a survey. Your support for unionization was really strong. Over 75% of you, cast a yes vote for collective bargaining. We're going to move forward. Hey, I met with Sheriff Weekly to share the results, and Sheriff Weekly expressed his continued support for us and the FOP." All right, so this is where maybe somebody might have, pooped the bed, as we may say. I don't know. I haven't talked
That's
to
a
anybody
legal term.
there today. Someone may have got out over their skis there, because not too long after that initial, well, you get that email, you go, "Hey, we're golden, right? The sheriff supports it. Everybody wants to unionize." Elected sheriffs or politicians, whether or not Sheriff Weekly was kind of glad handing the troops and saying, "Yeah, I support you," I don't know, right? And someday I'll know, because someone's going to come up to me at a seminar and tell me, the backstory here. But we don't know. The FOP represents that the sheriff supports the union, and then like you hear the brakes screech, and another email gets sent out from the FOP saying, "We're going to clarify that email that we sent out earlier. Sheriff Weekly supports us, and but he opposes collective bargaining. He supports the union, but he opposes collective bargaining, which is a little unusual." And so, what do you think happened there? I'm going to use my powers of my psychic powers and say somebody got their butt reamed out. So, Sheriff Weekly or someone else yelled at somebody and said, "I didn't support collective bargaining," right? And so this follow-up email is sent out to the troops saying, "Hey, not so fast. The sheriff supports the union. He supports you all, but he doesn't support collective bargaining." And then the sheriff himself sends out an email to everybody a little bit later. And I want to read from this email, Joe. I want to get your take on this. So here's the sheriff. "I want to be very clear that I oppose collective bargaining, and I feel it's totally unnecessary. In my opinion, adding another layer of bureaucracy by introducing collective bargaining between me, our employees, and our commissioners is completely unnecessary." And then he goes on, "I promise that I'll just, I'll give you flowers every Valentine's Day. I'm going to be the best boss ever. But there's this, I oppose collective bargaining. We don't need this extra layer of bureaucracy coming between you and me." Joe, does that sound familiar?
I mean, that's the playbook. I hear that every time. Every time I go into a private sector organizing campaign, they must all get the signs printed or the statements printed at the same shop, because I hear the same things from every employer, and it's all on that theme. We don't need this third party coming between us and our relationship, and this is going to make it harder for us to work together. We hear that all the time.
And the union's always the third party, right? The
That's
union's
right.
and you talk to people and you look around, and if you're in a 200 member department, or if you're in a 50 member department, who's the union? It's us, Right? It's
Right.
us. Like,
Who's
who's.
voting on whether or not to have a union in the shop? It's the people who work there, right? But they always make it a third party.
And so, why do they do that? Why do you think they do that?
Yeah, well, because it's an effective tool, and they're trying to drive a wedge between whatever organization is supporting these workers and making their, protected decision about whether or not to work together collectively to bargain with their employer. It's a strategy of othering where they say, this is this outside group, it's not you. They try and, throw their arms around the workers and say, we all work together, and who are these outside folks? In the vast majority of situations that I've experienced, a union organizing campaign doesn't start because some union sits there with a map of the country and says, oh, we're going to go after this city. It's because somebody within that organization doesn't like the way they're being treated, and they reach out and give somebody a call.
Yeah. And sometimes it's just where they, especially if you, it's a law enforcement agency, we know that there's lots of agencies where folks are organized and you see it happen, in other places. And you say, well, why don't we have that? And in
Right.
fact, isn't that something that can help with recruiting? And, yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And you noted playbook was like one of the first things you said. And so is there a playbook? And, tell me about like outside consultants. Do employers ever, get assistance with busting union campaigns?
Yeah, there is definitely a playbook. And the reason I use that term is because there are organizations that do this for a living, right? They call themselves labor relations consultants. And depending on who's running the White House and the federal agencies, those consultants can be required to disclose the contracts that they have with employers and importantly, how much money they're getting paid to do this work. And I'll tell you that, having reviewed some of these reports at the Labor Department's website, these guys are making $3,000 a day to come in and tell employees why it's not in their best interest to vote for a union.
Is that what happens? They'll bring people in and they'll just kind of be there for the duration of a campaign or for some significant part of it.
Absolutely. You'll have folks come in, they camp out. There's various types of meetings. We'll get into that.
Yeah.
But they're all over the place, meeting with people in various formats. One of the things about using these outside organizations is, this kind of reminds me of some of the work I did for the Defense Department as a contractor. You're less accountable because they can always say, well, this was just, these were just these people. Yeah, we paid them, but they were operating on their own, so we don't have to be held responsible for what they do. And it's a very similar, the labor organ consultants will come in and say all sorts of things, and then the company will kind of use the fact that they're an outside party as a buffer and say, oh, well, we didn't
We
say
didn't tell
that.
them to say that. We
That's
didn't
right.
know they were going to do that. That was
That's right.
that's too far. Yeah, I
Yeah.
mean the footprint of the consultant in this case, I think, comes up real soon, and it's with this next level of communication
Yeah.
that happens. And so after this initial, and I think the FOP might have messed up a little bit, all right, by saying the chief supports us. And so I don't know what happened. The chief might have gotten reamed out, or the sheriff, I don't know. But after the sheriff sends out his email saying, and he, by the way, he goes out of his way, says, I love the FOP. The FOP is great. I used to be a member of the FOP, and the FOP is awesome for lobbying and blah, 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 but not collective bargaining, right? And
Right.
so you get there's just a teensy weensy bit of hypocrisy there. We get that all the time. And Wheatley's a Republican, it's a heavily Republican area. I can tell you we see it everywhere. You see it on both sides of the aisle. And whether it's very conservative folks who just hate all unions, or whether it's sometimes you have very liberal folks that love unions except in their workplace.
Yeah, that's
And they
right.
have to
Not
have
in
a
my
union. Say, oh
backyard.
no, we don't
Yeah,
need a union here. Have
that's
one
right.
over there. So a little bit of hypocrisy from Sheriff Weekly. It happens, but then he starts sending out emails, like, and they say weekly emails. There are more than weekly, a couple times a week.
Right.
Starts sending out emails to employees, these did you know emails that he sends out. And it's, did you know that, your healthcare could get worse if you have a union? Did you know that? And it's just all these talking points, these short emails sent to sent to the workforce by Sheriff Weekly. Sheriff Weekly, I guess, apparently got really clever. He got really good at marketing and messaging, in the week after the union campaign started. This kind of stuff, these did you know emails, is that same playbook, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to joke. I guess the internet's a powerful thing. He just went on Google and found some union busting emails and put them together. But yes, no, this is exactly the kind of stuff that we would expect to see from a labor consultant. I see these sorts of emails all the time, and they're designed to walk right up to the line of what is under current law permitted. Depending on what jurisdiction you're in, the private sector, there are certain rules that are different from a lot of public sector labor laws in terms of what an employer is or is not allowed to say.
Give me an
And
example of, like, in the private sector, like, here's something an employer can get right up to the line and say, and maybe be okay. And this is all, everything's in flux now, and something
yeah.
that an employer, we all pretty much know, employer can't say.
Right. I mean, I think so. This case really kind of typifies the types of statements that we get from an employer, and it talks this case talks a lot about the concept of bargaining from scratch, and the idea that if you take the set of correspondence together and you look at them as a whole, there's an indication that the sheriff is has some animosity towards organizing, which I think is pretty obvious from his communications, and that the county's institution is indicating that they're gonna bargain over everything, that everything is up for negotiation. And that is, that's 100% true in the private sector. I think one of the interesting differences is that in the private sector, there are very few guardrails on what a company is allowed to say about its position on organizing. Right. And so, when the Labor Commission here was the division was looking at this set of communications, they were looking both at what is this sheriff saying about how he feels about unions, and then also what are these communications about, we're going to have to bargain over everything, and putting those together to find that that's coercive and that that's indicating that they may do regressive bargaining or other anti-union bargaining strategies. In the private sector, the NLRB would never put all those things together because the first set, the employer saying, I don't like the idea of union organizing, that's protected. They're allowed to say that.
And in Colorado, not so, right?
That's right.
Apparently.
Yeah.
And that's, we saw a lot of that here. I mean, Colorado's law is not bad. And, in some ways, like I said before, some of the state laws are better, some are worse. But, it's this drumbeat of kind of constant opposition to this idea. And this is just like a couple hundred cops are like, hey, man, let's have a contract, like the next county over. And all of a sudden they're getting hit with a lot of things. Tell me about these meetings, right? There's a in the industry, we talk about captive audience meetings, and
Right.
what are they like in the private sector? And did we see any of that? Like, what flavor of that occurred in this Colorado case?
Yeah, so and again, the law on this has changed a little bit recently, but what I have ex historically experienced with my clients in organizing campaigns, a captive audience meeting, it tends to follow one of a couple different types of scripts, but they are meetings where these consultants, sometimes it's an in-house person. I dealt with a company recently, a large national company, where I had an organizing campaign here in Philadelphia, and they have, because they do this all the time, they actually insourced it. They have a vice president of labor relations who just flies around the country doing union busting
He
campaigns.
screws his workers. Good.
Yeah.
Good for him.
And I think partly because of that, they had a certain tenor in these meetings, but it's a meeting where the employees are required to attend, and the purpose of the meeting is to allow the company to express its views on the union campaign and to talk about how the company is going to respond. Those meetings until quite recently were 100% lawful in the private sector. An employer could get in trouble for depending on what it said during those meetings. If it was threatening employees, with loss of benefits, or adverse working conditions based on unionization, or if it was promising things if they decided not to vote for the union. But in general, they were allowed to hold those meetings and follow this script,
So
this
tell
very
people
effective
that
script.
you don't have to, hey, you're off the shop floor, don't worry about it. Come
That's
on
right.
in, have a seat, put your feet up. Got pizza over there.
That's right.
I
Yeah,
want to tell you some
pizza.
stories about, man, have you heard about this union? It's actually the
That's right.
same. It's the FOP, but the FOP in you name it state, they had this issue. Ugh, and just start talking about bad things. Folks are getting paid,
Right.
right? And it's not just that they're getting paid. They can't leave. And well, in this case, and sometimes there's an issue. Well, can they leave? Can they not leave?
Right.
And in Douglas County, there was a little bit of that. They conducted some of these meetings in Douglas County in this particular case, and the employer, I believe, raised the defense that, well, no, that anyone could have left at any time. So they weren't necessarily a captive audience. The labor board didn't, I don't think, buy that argument. But that's not, so this is stuff that happens, this kind of playbook out there in the private sector of things that an employer can do within the rules, or maybe up to the line, to defeat a union organizing campaign, right? And
Right up to
what if
the
they
line.
cross the
Yeah.
line? What's the
Well, and
consequence there?
I mean that so first of all, the lines move around based on, who's interpreting the law at the time and what the specific circumstances are. But if they do go over the line in the private sector, oftentimes the consequence is pretty limited. So the way this would ordinarily work is if the union busting campaign is going on and they're violating, the NLRB would still potentially conduct an election. And depending on how that election came out, if the conduct of the employer was found to have crossed over the line, that would be what's called objectionable conduct, and it might be a basis for rerunning an election. Now, there has been a recent change in federal labor law with a decision called CEMEX, where the NLRB said if you engage in certain types of coercive behavior during the pre-election period, we're not going to have an election. We're just going to go ahead, and if the union has garnered enough support, if it got more than 50% card showing, that they're not going to hold an election. They would just order the employer to recognize and bargain with the union. I think the problem with that is that, first of all, it's relatively recent, and anything the NLRB does has to go up to a court of appeals and get reviewed and potentially go to the Supreme Court. And so the union folks that I work with have been careful about relying on that promise of getting a bargaining unit out of one of these CEMEX violations, because who knows how a court is going to view that precedent.
Yeah, there's a couple of things and things change. So let me break
Yeah.
that one down because I think it's interesting. I'll use the facts of this case. And the CEMEX decision, let's say before that, right? And I'm thinking of, you're in Philadelphia.
Right.
I'm in Philadelphia. People listening to this podcast come from different places, including maybe some down in Washington, where we played a football game a couple of weeks ago against. I won't say what they used to be called. They're called the Commanders, and the Eagles won. So the Eagles are in the Super Bowl. But people who watch that game will know the Eagles are doing the tush push. They're down on the goal line, right? You're inside the one, and there's no incentive for to the defense to follow any of the rules. They're jumping off sides, right? They're jumping over, they jump over the center, almost hit Jalen Hurts. And it got to the point where the referee says, "Hey, wait a minute. We are authorized. If you do that one more time, we can award the score, right? Because if we don't, there's no consequences for you to continue to violate the rules, right?" And that's kind of the CEMEX decision, isn't it? In a
That is a
sense,
great analogy.
it's like the tush
Absolutely.
push.
It's like the referees threatening to award a point. And without that, but you're right, without that kind of extraordinary measure, there's no incentive for the other side to play by the rules.
And if we were to use this, and it's Colorado, so this is a not a, we're in Douglas County, we're in a meat packing plant, we're not in the deputy sheriff's
Yeah.
office, and I'm the person who does the survey, and I'm the person who sends out the email, and everybody knows that Rick's trying to form a union, and let's say that I'm a pretty good employee, I'm not the worst, I don't trail a bunch of discipline, but I'm not the best, I'm just kind of in there, and but everybody knows it's Rick. The employer turns around and says, "You know what? Rick's fired."
That's right.
What are the consequences supposed to be to that, and how can employers in the private sector abuse that to get what they really want?
So you're right. Rick's going to get fired. That's the way it works. It's against the law, right? Technically, Section 8A3 of the National Labor Relations Act protects the right of employees to seek to organize, and an employer can't retaliate against somebody for wanting to join a union, for trying to organize a union, but it happens all the time. It is part of the playbook. It's sort of there's a hard and soft version of this, and the hard version of it is, yeah, you fire the organizers, you make the threats, and that person is definitely going to get removed from the workplace. They're going to get fired. The National Labor Relations Board has very limited ability to cure those types of situations. The remedies that they're limited to are reinstatement and back pay, kind of like in an arbitration. And so they can't go fine the company for doing something like that. Technically, they do have the right to go to a federal court and seek an injunction, a court order to get that person back in the workplace. And I actually did that once as an NLRB attorney with a organizing campaign that I was dealing with, and a union leader got fired, and we got her back to work. But it can be incredibly difficult to make that burden of proof to show that that person was fired for organizing, and it can take a long time. And actually, right now you can't do it at all because, the administration removed one of the members of the National Labor Relations Board. They're down to two, and based on some Supreme Court precedent from a decade or so ago, they no longer have the authority to operate, so they can't issue any decisions. And whereas the regional office, so the NLRB has offices all over the country, and they can do a lot of stuff by themselves. One thing they cannot do is go into court and seek an injunction against an employer. They can go seek one against a union without getting the board's permission. They can't go against an employer for one. So right now, there's no protection for those folks.
At all. Yeah. I mean, like the re and it's really rare. It's very, I mean, I actually didn't know that story about you with that injunction. In the business, it's extraordinarily rare if you can get the board to do that. And so you really, really, really need, the employer's got to be pretty dumb, to find themselves in that situation. But what you see is, hey man, I'm going to fire this person. It's going to take a zillion years to get to a hearing. I'm going to drag it out, going to delay, 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 and they'll probably get their job back at the end. It's just a make whole. If they worked in the interim, it's going to come off the top. It's not going to cost us that much money. But in the meantime, what's happened? You know what's happened? People got scared, and either we
Sends a
had the
message.
election and the union lost, or the election was postponed because we have this fight, and by that time, people forget about it, or we're going to start giving them raises in a quiet way, and when people listen to this, and the people who listen to this are generally in an organized workforce, either on the union side or the management side, folks who work with organized workforces. And the reason I'm talking about this case is that I think sometimes we forget how good it can be in the public sector in an environment where you don't have a lot of this active anti-union using consultants opposing organizing campaigns. In most instances, it's a little easier to do that. And you don't have to deal with this. And so when you read that, and it's true, I think something like 70, 75% of the American public supports unions. And that's it's a I think an all-time high right now. Why isn't 75% of the workforce organized? Well, it's because of this stuff. It's because of this stuff.
And there's a great example of this from last year. So, the United Auto Workers went on an organizing effort down south, and they went after the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, and they also went after a Mercedes plant in Alabama. And these were years-long campaigns, right? But they came to a head last year. And I think they'd actually had the UAW had had a prior loss at the Volkswagen plant. And what they did this time was somebody at the UAW intervened with Volkswagen corporate in Germany, where they have a very different approach to collective bargaining. And under German law, unions are required in workplaces, right? They're called worker councils. And so the headquarters operation at Volkswagen essentially ordered their American counterparts to back off, and they gave what's called a neutrality agreement, where they're basically just agreeing not to do all of this union busting
Not to cheat.
stuff. not to
Yeah.
cheat, right?
It's like, well, okay, we'll give you our
Right,
best game.
we'll just, stand back and let you talk to folks. And so I think a lot like the sort of the framework that's set up within the law in Colorado here that we've looked at. And when that happened, the Volkswagen plant went from a loss to 73% of the workers voting to organize. And then less than a month later, UAW had the Mercedes vote, which was in a plant where there was not a neutrality agreement. Mercedes did an active, union busting or union avoidance campaign. And out of 4,700 voters, I think Mercedes won the vote, got a no vote of 2,600 to 2,000 or something like that. Not a huge win for them, but enough. They got it over the line. And you can really see there the difference between, what happens when employees just have a chance to listen to their union and make their own informed choice versus what happens when those anti-union campaigns are allowed to proceed.
I mean, they pay for this stuff for a reason, right? They do this
Exactly.
stuff because it works. They don't do it because it's the right thing. And I would say it's not even the right thing for the business, but but some would say it is. It's the right thing for the owners to put money in their pockets. But in the public sector, you're like, well, whose money are you putting pockets in it? Don't tell me taxpayers, because that's not, you're not. These guys in Douglas County, and by the way, they lost this case. They lost the first round. The election was pushed off. We shall see. The FOP should keep fighting. But this is on appeal, I think. And so we'll see, where it goes. But I can guarantee you, if the Douglas County Sheriff is successful in beating back this union campaign, they ain't cutting taxes in Douglas County. Right. I mean, it's not going to happen. So, yeah, I don't know who benefits from this, other than these guys get to say they beat back a union. So, what, I mean, what lessons, or are there any lessons here for the listeners of this podcast? When we look at, this is a public sector example of some private sector tactics. Does what happens in the private sector, either coming out of the National Labor Relations Board or elsewhere, does that manifest itself in the public sector?
I think the place you really see that in this case is when you look at the communications from the commissioners themselves, right? So there was some discussion about the commissioners actually getting involved and sharing their views, and they're elected officials, so they have, like the sheriff, a certain level of protection for the types of things that they're allowed to say. But when I think you see all the tactics that go on in the private sector. You have people, people who are coming into elected office who, oftentimes they're coming in for the first time. Maybe they worked in the private sector before. They still have friends in the private sector. They're drawing on those experiences, right? So I think it's a fair shot that you'll see, particularly people in those kind of directly elected positions, city council people, county commissioners, importing those types of tactics into their union avoidance situations. They're going to come in with a whole set of, interests and political ideologies that are, I think, probably going to be different from what you might see from someone who's been part of the establishment for a while, a career government person.
It's true. And it's good to have that mix, in elected officials. But, when you have that new county commissioner or the new person that
Right.
comes in and says, well, my company, everybody pays 50% of the healthcare
That's
premium.
right.
And you say, well, this ain't your company, or, you name it, you name it. Well, why do you guys still have pensions? Well, my company wouldn't have pensions. Like, your company don't get shot at. I mean, there's differences. But, and people who listen to this will you bump up against that, sometimes. The other thing that I'll note, just for folks is, and we talk about this at the bargaining seminar, and I mentioned it a little bit. These state laws are all based on the National Labor Relations Act. And there will be some deviations, and there's different timelines, and the scope of bargaining is going to be different, and who can be in a bargaining unit is going to be different. And that's all going to vary state by state. But I can tell you from practicing before, public versions of the National Labor Relations Board in a couple in different states, that state labor boards are going to look to the National Labor Relations Board to fill blanks, and so. In the public sector right now, one of the big issues with our with mostly with policing, but with other groups, is artificial intelligence and the introduction of AI and these AI algorithms into the workforce and being used in discipline and for other things. We don't have any decisions yet, state labor boards, on what the extent of the bargaining obligation is for AI. I'm going to say I have some ideas about how it's going to turn out, but a lot of times the National Labor Relations Board is going to get to an issue first, just because it's national. There's more employers and there's more cases and more disputes, and so it does matter what happens with the National Labor Relations Board. It affects you. It affects directly a labor case that you may have in your state. And so, there are always changes administration to administration. Historically, that has been the case. It gets more conservative, it gets more liberal, and there's a process for that. If you break the process and have a labor board now that doesn't even have a quorum, folks might think, well, okay, that's tough sledding for the private sector, but it's tough sledding for the public sector too. We just haven't seen it yet. And so, that's stuff that we should all be thinking about and watching what's happening at the federal government level very closely, because what happens there can certainly happen, in our local departments. Joe, thank you so much for joining us this week. Or this month. I learned a lot. I think I have bad news for you. I think you're now our private sector correspondent. And I think there's going to be lots of messed up shit happening in the private sector
Well, that's
this
for
year.
sure. Yeah.
So maybe you could be our messed up shit correspondent.
Sounds good. Yeah.
And we'd love it if you'd come back and join us again. And thank you very, very much. That's it for the podcast this month, everybody. Thanks for giving us your time, and look forward to speaking to you again in March. Bye-bye.